hopefully my talk up to this point has given you enough grist for the mill to be able to kind of hang some thoughts on that and process that. Because what I want to do now, I've been at this kind of 40,000 foot level. I've been trying to give you the big picture at the top. And now we're going to start digging into some of the smaller parts. There's no way in the 5 or 6 hours we have together that we're going to be able to just unpack all of these things. We're just not going to be able to. But what we're doing now is we're sort of coming to the end of the big picture stuff. Because I wanted you to see that. Now we're going to start digging in a little bit. And I'm going to tell you about three aspects that characterize cultures that for whom the shame slider is very strong. Now, these aspects come from the Global Gospel book, which I encourage you to get. That's Werner Mischke's book. Now, he's got 9 of them, and we're only going to talk about 3. Those are the 3 that I've circled there. And I picked these 3 for a couple reasons. One is our own culture is changing, even right here. And our younger generations are increasingly shame and honor oriented. And I think these 3 principles, which historically have been quite foreign to our way of thinking, are growing in importance. And I'm going to tell you what they are in a bit. They're the ones that are circled, but I'll unpack them in a second. As we minister across generations, right here in our own culture. 2, I feel that these aspects of shame-based thinking, when they're applied to ourselves, kind of have the capacity to touch and heal and empower us in areas that we rarely address. And I spoke about that just a little bit a minute ago when we were looking at the heart diagram. And that we're not even aware sometimes that there are things that we're missing because of the glasses that we wear that might be actually hindering or keeping us from spiritual growth. And then we'll return to this aspect of personal transformation at the end, as I've said. So the 3 facets that I've chosen are the idea of limited good. You don't know what that means yet, but we'll be talking about that. The concept of faith and the value of purity. So we're going to do that shortly, but before we do that, I just want to dig into some specific characteristics of the honor-shame worldview. So let's take a quick kind of an overview of the general differences between the way that people in honor-shame societies process the world and the way that we do. I'm just going to look at another chart similar to the one that we did before, which was very individual. I did that thing versus, oh, I can't believe I did that thing, to some generalizations about the way these 2 kind of ways of thinking, our general way of thinking, being a guilt-oriented society, and the way shame-honor societies tend to view the world. Looking at equality, so more guilt-based is to the left, more shame-based is to the right. Inequality, more guilt-based. We're more likely to measure the worth of a person based on individual merits and performance. Whereas in shame-based societies, more likely to measure the value of a person based on age, position, title, rank, or tradition. Communication, our society, more direct. We're more likely to communicate in a direct manner, face-to-face. Cut to the chase, we like to say. And we value people who do that. We think that's a good thing. Shame-based societies tend to be indirect. They're more likely to communicate indirectly, especially in conflicts, through stories or a mediator in order to save face. Shame-based societies tend to be group-oriented societies. They're more likely to value the opinion of the family, harmony in the community, the welfare of the group, whereas we are more likely to value the uniqueness of each person. Individual human rights, it's a big deal for us. My own destiny, my rights. We tend to value task. We're very task-oriented people. And we lift up people who are task-oriented. So CEOs are heroes in our culture, for example. We're more likely to value work accomplished, efficiency in getting the job done. They are more likely to value relationship in this continuum. They're more likely to value personal relationships. Social harmony trumps efficiency. And anybody who's lived overseas knows this to be true. We like risk. And we hold up people who take risks and win. We hold them up as heroes. We're more likely to venture forth rapidly, to experiment with new ideas, not knowing how things will work out. We're cool with that. They are more cautious. That's what their culture leads them to believe is the right way to proceed. They're more likely to go cautiously, slowly, keep what one has gained, even though it may be small. These are very important things to understand as you cross cultures into shame-based cultures, because these things drive Americans crazy. And they will drive you crazy if you go into a shame-based culture. Now, of course, not all these things will be true all the time, and each one of these things is a slider, so keep that in mind. But basically, these are the tendencies. Let's introduce the idea of limited good. Limited good. You have no idea what I'm talking about, because the idea of limited good is absolutely baffling to Westerners attempting to help people who live in shame-based societies. You know, we come, as Americans, at least previous generations of Americans came, from societies where resources seemed boundless, were plentiful, where men and women's capacity to better themselves were and are, we believe, only limited by their giftings and their enterprising spirit. We've grown up in a land where natural resources have been so plentiful that they feel, for all practical purposes, to be limitless. And this has had a profound effect on how we view the world and what we value. Now, let me ask you a question. You can just shout it out. What are some assumptions that we as Americans have about the world that describe our beliefs about the potential of people to better themselves? Anybody? Sometimes we have little sayings. Any little sayings we have? Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Absolutely. With anyone can be president. Keep trying if you fail. Where there's a will, there's a way. I need to write these down, because you guys have lots of ones that I've missed. God, I love it. I love it. Carla, you writing these down, because there's a whole bunch of good ones here that I... A rising tide lifts all boats. Yeah, that's right. That's a good one too. Wow. We really believe this. Okay? Even when it's not true, this is something about the mythology about ourselves that we believe and shapes what we believe to be right and what we believe to be wrong. One of the most difficult things about what we're doing here this weekend is that it is honestly almost impossible for somebody who's been plunged in one culture their whole life to conceive of a world where right and wrong is not right and wrong. I mean, this is what is so difficult about what we're doing here tonight and tomorrow. I'm trying to help you understand what it's like to look through the eyes of a person who does not process the world through right and wrong. Can you imagine that? Try and imagine thinking about your life and what you ought to do without right and wrong. Now, that doesn't mean that these people do not have terribly strong senses of what ought to be and what ought not to be. They do. But they don't use right and wrong to decide those things. And quite honestly, it is incredibly difficult for us to even put ourselves in their shoes to kind of look out their eyes and see things the same way. That's what's so difficult about the task that I have before me and before us in the next few hours. That's what I'm trying to get to. So this is a bit of what we believe as Americans. We are armed with these core beliefs. Oh, another one, manifest destiny. Manifest destiny. And you, of course, that was a big thing back in the 1800s and even before. But now, you know, that's turned into we really see ourselves as being, you know, we ought to be the protector of the world. We are the leader of democracy. You know, we use all these terms and we don't realize how incredibly arrogant they sound to the rest of the world. But for us, this is really part of who we are, because manifest destiny, this is our destiny as a people. But armed with these core beliefs, we enter shame-based cultures with our programs for local small business development, for education, for leadership training, and we often just run into a brick wall. You know, I've talked with several good-hearted, caring Western Christian businessmen. They came to Morocco to put on a business training seminar, and they left completely disillusioned because there was something about shame-based cultures that no one had explained to them. No one explained to them the principle of limited good. Now, I'll obviously be unpacking this because so far this makes no sense to you. The image of limited good is the belief that everything in the social, economic, natural universe, everything desired in life, land, wealth, respect, status, power, influence, everything exists in finite quantity and is in short supply. Therefore, and this is the important bit, if you gain, I lose. It's a zero-sum game. This, folks, is how most of the world processes life. Most of the world believes this. And we are actually very fortunate to have grown up in one of the very unique cultures in the world and in history of the world that has had injected into it the idea that there's actually an infinite amount of good out there and we can all get better together. When you win, it doesn't mean that I lose. Very, basically more than 70% of the rest of the population of this earth do not think that way. And Americans, when they're trying to help other people, struggle because they don't get the idea of limited good. I have some stories about that, but I'm running out of time. So at the end, if there is time, you can ask me, make a note, and I'll tell you some stories about people who came to Morocco, and I can unpack more about some of these businessmen and how things worked out for them. Since life is a competition for scarce resources, forget about playing by the rules in order to move up the ladder. Okay? We believe in the rules. We believe that the bag boy can someday be the CEO of the grocery store or the grocery chain. But the rungs of the ladder of opportunity in shame-based societies are seen as fixed, for the most part. And so, the social political system is not there to help you. Rather, it exists to keep you in your place. And so, the only real opportunities are through friends and family who may be better placed than you are, up the rungs of the ladder, in order that they can give you a hand up. So that's how you get ahead in society. You don't work hard, because that doesn't work. Because it's a zero-sum game. If I win, somebody else is losing, and therefore everybody else is trying to keep me from winning. So how do you get ahead? It's all relationship. And hopefully, you can make a relationship with somebody who's a rung above you. It's really great when they're family, and then they can give you a hand up. That's how you get ahead. That's how you get ahead. And this is one of the things that people who come trying to do micro business, trying to do development, good Christian businessmen trying to get these guys, just really struggled with. because they couldn't understand why people had to start at the top. And that's what they kept running into. And you had all these college kids who had good educations, but the job situation was so bad, and they were just sitting around twiddling their thumbs. They wouldn't do anything. Now, there were jobs available at the lower level. They could have gone and worked in a coffee shop, but they wouldn't do it. Why wouldn't they do it? They wouldn't do it because I've got a college education. There is no way I am going to go and serve coffee. Once I go down to that bottom rung, I'm never getting out of it. It's better for me to sit at home doing nothing than for me to go work in that coffee shop. And that is an amazing example of the way that the idea of limited good affects the way that you process the world. Anyway, in our next session tomorrow morning, we'll be returning to look at the Bible's answer to the concept of limited good when we explore the fullness of the global gospel. And we'll be starting to dig into the word tomorrow morning. Now, the concept of faith is our next, next one of the three that I've chosen for our introductory session here. Now, this is a concept that you actually may have some sense of what it is. You have no doubt heard something, especially if you've traveled in the East or have read about what the idea of faith is. Anybody? Yeah, there's the idea. We're talking about saving faith. That's exactly right. What does that mean exactly? That's right. You know, that's you're exactly in the ballpark of what we're talking about here. This is a concept that's more familiar with us, even though it's not really part of the way we look at the world. But I just wanted to be clear that when we're talking about faith here, we're not talking about the body part, right? We're using this term as a metaphor, which is the way that many of these cultures, and particularly the Chinese culture, uses to represent a person's self-awareness in terms of their sense of self-respect and dignity in a given situation. In other words, when a person loses faith, they are publicly shamed. Relationship is immediately strained or it's broken. So, why is the concept of faith important? It's important because, one, it's historically been largely unknown in our society, though again, and you'll hear me say this over and over again, this is changing. It's especially strong in cultures in the East and in Southeast Asia, China, Korea, Japan, Indonesia, for example, Thailand, although it is also very much part of Arab culture as well, although they don't necessarily use the actual word faith like Asian cultures, specifically the Chinese do. But it is also a big part of Arab and Middle Eastern culture, and we'll be seeing the importance of the idea of faith in Scripture tomorrow. Faith in Chinese culture. There are many ways to lose faith. These are notes. I am not an expert in Chinese culture, so these are things that I have drawn from both. Primarily from Werner Mischke's research. He quotes, there are many ways to lose faith in Chinese culture. Some are minor, like forgetting words to a song or tripping while walking. There are any number of bad habits that can make people lose faith. You know, other reasons are more serious. One shows having mental illness. One study, for example, shows that having mental illness or a disease or getting arrested or tested for AIDS, not even if you don't have it, just getting tested for AIDS is a way of losing faith. Can cause loss of faith, leading to loss of relationship, discrimination, even denial of medical care in the Chinese medical system. There are two aspects that consistently appear when we encounter issues of faith and honor. First It's always social or public. Faith, again, is one of these, faith is one of these issues that is entirely related to how the people around you look at you. It's a community thing. And secondly, it expresses worth or status. This is what we mean by faith. And we're kind of building a framework here to talk about faith in the Bible tomorrow. But as a result, there are people in the world, like the Chinese, who define themselves not so much by what they do, as by who they know. And in Chinese culture, the word is guanxi, relationship, is the leading functional savior. giving and receiving faith is the way to enter, to sustain and strengthen relationships. So it's not just having faith, but you give faith. So what that means is that in relationship, you're not only aware of your faith, but you're aware of how you're relating to the to a person in front of you adds or takes away to their faith. And so relationship isn't just trading words. Relationship becomes an interaction, an honor interaction, where people are giving and receiving faith. That may sound a little strange to your ears, but that's actually what's going on in many, many cultures. And if you want to ask me about that, I'm actually almost done here, so there'll be opportunities to talk. But I can talk about examples of that in Moroccan culture as well. So the main idea behind this exploration of the concept of faith is that in addition to the fact that faith is a very prominent social and cultural dynamic amongst more than 2.1 billion people in East and Southeast Asia, there's likewise abundant material about faith in the Bible. We'll be seeing that. And why this overlap? The contemporary societies of East Asia and the ancient societies of the Bible have this in common: the cultural value of honor and shame. And we're going to explore that, as I said, what the Bible has to say about saving faith in the next session tomorrow morning. The value of purity. This is our third and final sort of pillar to honor and shame societies that I've picked out of the nine. We had limited good, faith, and now we're looking at purity, the value of purity. Now, purity is the condition or the perception that one is acceptable before a holy God according to a specific system of rules. And these rules define boundaries for what is holy or and common, or sometimes in the Bible it's often called clean and unclean. There's also the word abomination comes into this. What we have here is a really just kind of helpful, very simple chart to sort of peek into the mind of an honor-shame person. In this case, somebody from the Old Testament. And have an understanding of how they divide up the world. You've got the common, you've got the unclean, and you've got abomination. And the Old Testament is filled with the concept of clean and unclean. You know, this is purity language. It's part of the vocabulary of honor and shame that is no longer of much use in our culture, it seems like. So let me introduce you to the concept from the perspective of the Old Testament, and we'll return to it in the next session. I'm just going to read to you from Leviticus 18. Do not make yourselves unclean by any of these things. For by all these, the nations I am driving out before you have become unclean. And the land became unclean, so that I punished its iniquity, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my rules, and do none of these abominations, neither by the native or the stranger who sojourns among you. For the people of the land who were before you did all these abominations, so that the land became unclean, lest the land vomit you out when you make it unclean. as it vomited out the nations that were before you. For everyone who does any of these abominations, the person who does them shall be cut off from among their people. Notice this is all honor and shame language. So keep my charge never to practice any of these abominable customs that were practiced before you, and never to make yourselves unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. Oh, I forgot that last line. So the wider context of this passage, you know, kind of covers the whole range. This, if you look at the verses ahead and before and after what I read, covers not giving your best. These all the things that that come under the topic of uncleanness and abomination. Not giving your best, the best sacrifice to the Lord. Then it goes on through infidelity, bestiality, homosexuality, offering children to Molech. Now note that all of these sins are not discussed in the context of law and grace or sin and guilt. They are described in the context of purity and defilement. Purity and defilement. And the vast majority of the people of this earth value the ideal of purity far, far more than we do. And this is a blind spot for us when we enter into their cultures or when they come into our cultures. It's so funny because we often look at them as almost unclean, as kind of people that, you know, well, I'm going to make an effort to go and talk to that person because, I don't know, you know, there's just these barriers and things. And sometimes it's hard for us to even imagine that many of these Muslim people are looking at us and they're saying, how can they do those things? Don't they realize they are defiling themselves? And we don't see that at all. We just don't see it at all. Buddhists expend incredible time and mental energy in the effort to purify themselves from moral and character defects so that nirvana may be obtained. Hindus have many forms of ritual purification, from bathing in holy rivers to escaping into altered states of consciousness. Like the river they bathe in often is the Ganges, one of the dirtiest rivers in the world, and you can see that it has nothing to do with physical cleanness. Islam has construed probably the most complex system of ritual purification since the Pharisees. And I think it's critical that we understand that while the vast majority of the people on this planet do not go through life burdened like Christian and Pilgrim's Progress by a load of guilt for their sinfulness, they do go through life carrying the heavy burden of living in a near constant state of defilement. For the Muslim, every element of their daily lives is ordered by this insecurity. There is a proper direction to face when falling asleep. The Arabic words uttered when beginning a task, speech, or a greeting, even the way you blow your nose, the foot you place in the bathroom first. All of these things can make you unclean. Defilement comes in various levels, and for each level, there is an appropriately matching cleansing. Burping and passing gas is one level of defilement. Touching your private parts is another. Touching semen, urine, feces, or menstrual flow is getting pretty serious. Serious enough that a woman's prayers will not be heard during her period. In Morocco, some years ago, we were very good friends with another missionary couple who had built a very strong relationship over years with a Moroccan family who they thought they knew very well. They went camping with them. They were close. They talked. And after knowing this family for, I think, more than 5 years, they learned to their astonishment that this family, and it was a family with the parents, and then there were three or four kids. They learned that there was another kid that nobody knew about who all these years had been in the back room. And this kid was in the back room because it was deformed. It had been born physically deformed and had a disability of some kind, maybe not enough oxygen when it was born or something. And this child brought so much shame to the family that they hid it away. They fed it back there and took care of it, but it never came out. Many of their closest friends did not know it even existed. And when you realize that what you have to do to be clean is pray a certain way or do a certain thing, what if you can't do those things? If you're a Muslim and you need to bow a certain way to do it right, but you are physically handicapped and can't do that, oh, there might be alternatives, but everybody knows that they're not as good. You are living in a state, not of guilt, but of defilement. In this case, over something you had nothing to do with. You were born this way, or you had an accident. This is what the majority of people on this planet are struggling with. So I'll be returning to this issue of purity and defilement, in our next sessions as well, as we look into what the Bible has to say about this and try to integrate God's gift of purity into the gospel that we preach, both internally to ourselves and that we preach to others. Well, as we draw this to a close here, good to kind of understand some of the tendencies of guilt-based societies versus shame-based societies. There actually is, I think, an invisible benefit. You will never hear me judge and say, this is better than that. It's not necessarily moral things. The Bible itself was written, as we will see tomorrow, in an honor-shame context, and I will try to prove to you that it is an honor-shame book. But so this is not a value judgment, but there are invisible benefits to seeing the world primarily through the lens of guilt and innocence, as we have had the benefit of in our society. One is that the tension of remorse and regret of guilt tends to cause us to stop and perhaps rethink things. When you feel guilty, you kind of want to think about it ways out, you know, and that's not a bad thing. It presses us to confess, to apologize, to make amends for. Those are the kinds of things that it tends to do. And as a result, we truly can become better people. You know, the world does become a better place when you're motivated to do some of those things because of guilt. So that's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And in contrast, as I said earlier, shame is a much stronger, it's a more visceral emotion, and it can have more violent consequences, whether they are self-destructive or destructive of other people. But when people feel ashamed, they're not particularly motivated to apologize. They're not particularly motivated to attempt to repair the situation. So it's not an emotion that tends to lead people to kind of responsibly own up to their failures or mistakes, transgressions, and make things right. Instead, as I said, they're often inclined to engage in all sorts of defensive maneuvers. You know, they may withdraw or avoid the people around them. They may deny responsibility and blame others for the shame-eliciting situation. They may become downright hostile, angry at the world that has made them feel so small. In short, shamed individuals are inclined to assume a defensive posture rather than take a constructive, kind of reparative stance in their relationships. And we will explore both the positive and the negative tendencies of guilt-oriented and shame-oriented worldview in our final session, when we focus on developing what I've been calling the global gospel. A gospel that speaks to the whole human condition. If you're interested, this is just something I ran across literally in the last couple of weeks. There's a website out there called The Culture Test, where you can actually take a little kind of online thing, and it helps you. You can take it either from your perspective, or you can take it from the perspective of a culture that you're working with or a person that you may know. And it's one of those things that kind of helps you kind of process some of this shame versus guilt-oriented thing. So check it out. It's kind of fun. It's very simple and perhaps a bit simplistic, but still, it's a good tool to kind of get the wheels turning a little bit. So I throw that out there. That was the end of our first session. Now, it may be that you have some questions. I know this has been a flood of information, and I have spoken quickly, and we're talking about mind-bending things, trying to look at the world through the eyes of people who have values that may be very, very different from ours. If you, we actually have more time tonight than we'll have tomorrow. We'll be keeping the sessions to, about an hour and 50 minutes each, and the two sessions, hour and a half. But there is some time tonight for some questions if you'd like. So if anybody has some things you've written down or thought of, I'll take you first. I didn't see who was what the order was. As I said, I can't see very well. Yeah. So for the recording here, the question is, how did this happen? How did some people end up being more shame-oriented and some people more guilt-oriented? I will give you my opinion. First, I will say this. Our society as a primarily guilt-oriented society is not the norm throughout history. We are the exception. If you look at the kind of the arc of human history going back as far as we can see, human history has by and large operated by the principles and the worldview of shame and honor. So we are quite unusual in that. It's possible that some of the things, you know, our culture was shaped by Judeo-Christian ethics. And Judeo-Christian, and more specifically, we were shaped by the Judeo-Christian ethics as formulated by the Western half of the Christian church. If you know much about church history, you know that the Roman Empire split around the time of Constantine. The Roman Empire was in trouble and it became too big to manage. And so they split it into an eastern half and a western half. The western half was ruled by Rome and the eastern half was ruled by Constantinople. Now by that time there was an active Catholic church. But what happened when the western part of the church and the eastern part of the church, what happened when the empire split is that the church also split. And it's very interesting that going back to our early church fathers who people like Tertullian, these are people in the 100s, 200s, 300s who were defending the faith. They were people who were defending the deity of Christ. They were fighting against heresies. They were fighting Gnosticism, and all of these guys were lawyers. And it's interesting to see how the Western Church, in the process of really defining themselves in front of what initially was quite a hostile society and an emperor who sometimes came down hard and things, really, really keyed in on some of these very strong legal aspects which were available to them in the Roman world, because Rome had a very strong legal system, one of the strongest legal systems in the world, and our legal system today is based on the Roman legal system. It's interesting because when you look at the writings of the early church fathers who were Eastern, they actually look at the gospel much more through the lens of honor and shame. It's quite interesting. Some of those early church fathers from the Eastern end of things barely talk about the gift of redemption through Christ. What they tend to talk about is more honor-oriented things, how God lifts people up, seats them with princes, raises people's faces up, does things like that. So it's kind of interesting to me it's not like I haven't done a doctorate on this or anything like that. But so I'm giving you my opinion, and if you ask me in 5 years when I know more, I may change this. But this is where I'm at right now. It's just that all I can tell you is that I'm curious, and that I see that going back even to the split between East and West, that I almost kind of see the seeds of beginnings of some of this really strong legal language in the church that later influenced some of the major philosophers like John Locke and others, who then our own founding fathers placed a lot of weight on, and I think influenced our society as well. So I think there's something to that. It's worth exploring further to see how deep that goes. Yeah. Okay, in limited good, the key idea in limited good is that if you win, I lose. It's a zero sum game. Okay. Oh, okay. I think what I said it was kind of an off notes comment. Tell me if we're talking about the same thing. But at some point, I talked about trying to get people to understand that there are people in this world who do not process the world through what is right and what is wrong. And that is extraordinarily difficult for us to even imagine how you might think through that grid. Because right and wrong is so much a part of the way that we think that honestly, if I hadn't said that, most of you would probably have said, well, it's impossible. Everybody believes in right and wrong. You know, even if they're running away from it, now, even people in our society who run away, like, you know, we obviously, as we well know, our society is changing. We're changing laws and doing all these things. And it's tempting to say, well, it's because nobody believes in right and wrong anymore. But I would tend to say, well, you have all sorts of people who don't want to be told they're wrong. And it's still a guilt oriented thing. They don't want to be made to feel guilty because they are pursuing homosexual lifestyles or doing these different things. It's still very much that, right? So it still is right and wrong.
That's what you were saying. That's exactly what you're saying. One thing in my mind, what
to do with food. Yeah. That's exactly what we're talking about. That is, they do have what they would call truth, but they would not say that. Let me tell you a story. And it illustrates a bit the way we think about truth and ultimate truth and not. And it's a story that many of you know, because many of you perhaps read Corrie Ten Boom's book. When I was a kid, I read it, The Hiding Place. And if you know the story, you know that, you know, this is a Dutch family. She grew up in this Dutch family, and they hid Jews during World War II. And as I recall, they had like a space that was under the floor of the living room, and they had made a trap door. They put the Jews under there, closed the trap door, put a carpet over it, and then they put the dining room table on top of it. And the Nazis came. And the Nazis came, and Corrie Ten Boom was just a little girl. She's trembling and she's afraid. And one of the soldiers said, pointed at the table and said, "Are the Jews under the table?" And Corrie did not know what to do, because she was a good Christian girl, and she knew that lying was wrong, always wrong. And she had a tremendous guilt crisis. And because she knew that you never ever lie, she said, "Yes, they are under the table." And the Nazi officer pulls up the tablecloth, looks under, he doesn't see anything. And he says, "She's just a little girl, doesn't know what she's talking about," and they storm out. Okay. A person from an honor-shame context would not have had that struggle. Not at all. In fact, a person from an honor-shame context would have said, "That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Obviously she should have lied. Lying in that situation is the truth. That is what she should have done. And I cannot imagine that anybody in their right mind would have struggled with whether to lie or not in this situation. Do you see the difference in terms of how you view absolute truth? Do you see that? Well, that's very interesting. Now, Abraham lies about Sarah. It doesn't work out too well for him. Okay? Now, can somebody else give me an example, somebody in Scripture who lies and it's the right thing to do? Rahab. Rahab lies through her teeth. And you know what happens? In the book of Hebrews, she's listed as one of the champions of faith. And in the book of James, again, she's mentioned twice in the New Testament. Okay? And we will, I don't even know if I use that story tomorrow, but it's a great illustration of the difference of how people, even in the Bible, view truth versus the way that we view truth. Well, they have what they view as truth, and they would say that what is true to do varies on the situation, and that the right thing to do is that you do what brings the least shame. If lying brings the least shame, that is the right thing to do. So it is much more relative, but that is an... But this is why I said earlier, it's very hard for us to imagine a world without right and wrong. And by right and wrong, I'm talking about these sort of ultimate truths that you're talking about. And switch over to a worldview where it's not ultimate truths, but there are very, very strong feelings of what ought to be and what ought not to be. These are not people who just lay around like wet blankets and don't believe in anything. They believe in things really strongly. In fact, they believe in things so strongly, they'll kill their kids over it. That's how strong they believe in something being what ought to be and what not, ought not to be. But the way they arrive there is totally different from the way that we do. That's what's so difficult about what we're talking about. I don't know if that makes sense, but... yeah, back there. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What do I say? And God said, tell him he's going to need a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Which I find very interesting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You are absolutely right. I had forgotten that story, but it's a great illustration. And I guess it's kind of building up to the point that I'm going to make tomorrow, and I'll just make it now. That is that the Bible is an honor and shame book. And quite honestly, when I did my Master's of Divinity degree and I look back on that now and I realize that I actually took entire classes where we debated all sorts of things in systematic theology that now I realize looking back that if I was to transport those questions way back to the time that they were written in the Bible, they probably wouldn't have been big deals. But that because we are so driven to have a black and white legal answer based on ultimate truths, it's like for us, we've turned theology into a science. And therefore, we've got to make it all work out. And guess what? When you read the Bible, it doesn't all work out. There's all sorts of things that if you are only trapped in that view, will actually be contradictions, or they will be, if nothing else, puzzlements to you. Like that story. What? God told them to lie? But through the lens of honor and shame, actually it makes good sense. And it made great sense to the people at the time. And it was righteous. Yeah, you were going to say? I think you had a follow-up. Good one. Very good one. You writing those down, Carla? We add them tomorrow. Is there anybody else? I know, yeah. Okay, these three things that we've talked about face, we talked about the concept of cleanliness and uncleanliness, and we talked about the concept of limited good. They all fall under honor and shame. So it's not another way, it's not a synonym for honor and shame. These are three common characteristics of honor and shame cultures. It's not saying that you're always going to find all three, and kind of like I said, In the Global Gospel book from which I'm pulling some of these concepts, he's actually got nine of them. Nine facets of honor and shame cultures. I picked these three. So it's not the same, but it is very often something that you will find in those cultures. You're likely to find them. Does that help or? Between the concept of cleanliness and uncleanliness and the concept of honor and shame? Well, okay. I guess I see your point. Being in a state of uncleanliness is being, in a sense, in a state of shame. That is true. There are many cultures, kind of, I gave some examples in Muslim cultures of, particularly for women, women are of lesser status than men. And that, and in a sense, they are, in a more shameful status than men, and part of their some people would say that in that society, the honorable woman recognizes her shameful status. In other words, it sort of sounds like doublespeak, but that's kind of how it works. There are these different aspects of potential uncleanness that you can enter into. Depending on your system, well, I gave examples that were familiar to me because they tend to be characteristic of Muslim societies. I am not familiar with Hindu societies. I've never lived in India, and I've never lived in Asia, for example. So all that information is stuff I read in books. I am familiar, you know, I do have firsthand knowledge of things that make people unclean, and I would not say being in a position of uncleanness might be a very personal thing that people don't know about, or it might be a very, very public thing, like being a beggar, being maimed, and not having a limb, being in a position where you cannot do the prayers, like I mentioned. Those are things in Muslim societies that people take very, very seriously because it's not people don't just look at them and say, oh well, he's a poor guy, he's disabled. They say that, but they also look at them and say, that person is unclean before God. Yeah, in Muslim cultures? Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. Although they practice it very much. Correct. Yeah. I think I would say it a little differently. I mean, I think I would say that people who operate through the lens of honor and shame will have certain tendencies of processing. And one of the things you commonly find in these cultures is very developed codes of how you become defiled or not defiled. And these are things that are just completely foreign to us in our culture. But for them, it can be very simple things, and I gave some simple examples, or it can be really serious things. So I feel more comfortable stacking them rather than putting, I feel like, and I don't know if I'm understanding you right, but I feel like you're kind of putting them next to each other, and I feel like this is more like, this is like the umbrella of honor and shame, and this is one of the likely things that you often find in the context of the thinking of these kind of people, is that they have different things that they understand. If you do them, you are unclean before God. You can't, your relationship with Him is broken until you do something to flip yourself back into the clean mode. Does that make sense? I'm not.
Yeah.
And then you have kind of had that big circle. At the bottom, you have the abominable people. And a lot of these cultures have the abominable section. You know, in India, there's the untouchables and so on. These are people for whom there is no hope. They live in a constant state of irrevocable uncleanness. You mean in those cultures? Well, that certainly brings shame. Yes, that certainly brings shame. Now, when you're talking about uncleanness and cleanness, though, you're more talking about whether that person's relationship to God has been severed or not. Whereas, in other words, I look at you, I think you've done this thing. You're unclean, and I see you as a person who's no longer in communion with God. Whereas honor and shame is more general. It doesn't have to involve God at all. It can be community or family or whatnot. So, if you have a drunk in your family, that certainly brings shame on the person and on your whole family. But it doesn't necessarily make you unclean before God. Does that make sense? Do you see the difference? That would be something that you've done that brings guilt to the whole family. Now, it doesn't necessarily make you unclean. Okay? Again, the cleanness, uncleanness has a strong, it's a very vertical thing. It has to do whether you are clean and acceptable before God or not. And I know that's hard for us to understand because we tend to think that there are things that you do, like being drunk, that severs your relationship with God. But actually, most of the world doesn't look at it that way. And you're putting your finger on exactly why it's so hard to get ourselves into that frame of mind. Because you're talking about things that people do, like sins, that you should feel guilty for and that should sever your relationship with God. And what I'm trying to tell you, which is so hard to say, is that most people in the world don't actually feel like those guilty things sever their relationship with God. So, but there are other things that make them clean or unclean, which are much more based on kind of the pecking order of society and things that they do or have even happened to them, illnesses and things like that, that are, yeah. All right. Sounds good. A preview of what the Lord's done. Well, talking about tomorrow. I'll tell you where I'm going to end up so you know where the... And it's Hannah's psalm, "I have come to love that piece of Scripture." You should go back to 1 Samuel sometime and read that whole story. I wish I had time to unpack it for you, because that's an entire story that has nothing to do with guilt. And it doesn't even have anything to do with fear. But it is all about a woman in the depths of shame. And where we're going to end up is that God lifts you up from the ash heap, and He seats you with princes. And I think that is the most liberating thought, the most wonderful thing. And I think that is grist for the mill, not just to have your ticket to heaven, but it's the kind of fuel that will energize you to actually walk with God, to desire a relationship with Him. And that's exactly the foundation on which missions is built. And we'll see that actually the missionary enterprise is an incredibly honorable thing when you start seeing that everything that we do and our entire lives as Christians is actually for the glory of God. Now, we've always said this. You know this. John Piper wrote a great book years ago called Let the Nations Be Glad. This is not necessarily an unknown concept. But when you start understanding the Bible through the lens of honor and shame, you start seeing the reason for the kingdom of God in different ways. And even the words that, you know, our lives and His kingdom are for His glory and all of creation start taking on new meaning. That's where we're going. That's where we're going to end up. Let's pray. Father, thank You so much. I know it's been a ton of information and it's hard just to, especially in the evening, to sit for nearly 2 hours and just drink out of a fire hose. But I'm grateful to You, and I just want to pray, Father, that if there's even just one, two, or three things from this evening that person or people here needed to hear, that You'll kind of burn that into their hearts, take them home. May they be tools and things for them to mull on for many weeks to come. I ask this in Your name. Amen.